Iran unveils its latest nuclear achievements, including in the field of enrichment, as the country marks its National Nuclear Technology Day. Saudi Arabia executes three of its soldiers over what it calls committing high treason without providing any details. And people demonstrate in Australia's major cities to protest the deaths of indigenous people in police custody. Hello and welcome from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us right here to Iran today, where Iran has unveiled new achievements in its nuclear industry on National Day of Nuclear Technology. In a virtual ceremony, President Hassan Rouhani launched a new generation of centrifuge assembly center at the Natanz facility. He also started gas injection into IR-6 and IR-5 centrifuges there while launching the mechanical testing of IR-9, the second phase of industrial production of deuterium combinations, as well as a center for the separation and application of stabilized isotopes, were also launched at the Fordow site. Rouhani said the inaugurated projects reveal the country's high technological know-how. He also emphasized that Iran's nuclear activities are peaceful and in accordance with international treaties. Rouhani said Iran has never been after atomic weapons and that no one in the world can prevent his country from pursuing its peaceful nuclear program.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. We're back once again with a familiar topic, the Iran nuclear deal, and rightfully so. I mean, after all, it was hailed as a historic pact when it was signed back in 2015, and it also made the rounds again when the U.S. pulled out of it back in 2018. So, the talks continue between Iranian representatives and other signatories to the deal to find a way to revive the deal. Tehran says it has come up with a logical path to doing so, which involves the American removing the sanctions in its entirety. And just then, Iran should be able to verify it, as the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, suggested. Meaning, Iran should be able to sell its oil under normal conditions and receive its money. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif had a tweet detailing this, and the internet reacted to it. So let's check out his tweet and the reactions to it. So the tweet itself reads, Iran proposes logical path to full JCPOA compliance. Here it is. The U.S., which caused this crisis, should return to full compliance first. Iran will reciprocate following rapid verification. All Trump sanctions were anti-JCPOA and must be removed, without distinction between arbitrary designations. All right, and here we have three replies to this tweet. The first one coming from Mohammad Sadat. He wrote, certainly the United States seeks to strike at Iran and trades when it always makes a profit. So the Islamic Republic must act with full awareness and full hand and stand against the United States and not submit to oppression and break the global arrogance. I think it's safe to say that that's what Iran has been doing this whole time, resisting global arrogance. All right, the next tweet comes from Nur al-Kun. It says, the administration of His Excellency President Biden is pursuing a method that is completely contrary to the previous administration. And this in itself is a sign of hope for a breakthrough in the crisis and overcoming all obstacles, God willing. Well, let's just hope that His Excellency's plan will hold. I have my doubts. The next comment comes from Mohammed. It reads, why all this fuss about Iran's nuclear program while everyone is silent about Israel's ready nuclear bombs? That's a good question which has been asked again and again and again and again with no real answer ever being presented. But seriously, do you think that the U.S. media conglomerates will chastise their owner? I think not. And there you go. That's your answer. The next batch of tweet, the first one comes from Mohammad Saidi. It says, lifting of all economical sanctions, re-entering back into the JCPOA, and guaranteeing that reckless policies like that of Trump must never happen again is the only way forward. All right, our next tweet comes from Bahram. It reads, "Diplomacy and negotiations are the only logical alternatives remained. Besides some juvenile rants and personal hatred, those opposing Zarif propose no other solutions. War, isolation, and empty manly talk is a big win for Mohammed bin Salman and Netanyahu only, not for Iran. Diplomacy is what Iran is pursuing here." All right, the next one comes from R. Bhatti. It says, "The U.S. is the problem. The U.S. also needs to address its piracy, impounding Iranian oil, selling it, and keeping the proceeds. The U.S. is a rogue state. They also have to answer for their other aggressive foreign policies." But will they? The next one comes from Clear Vision. It says, "The news about Iran cooperating with China was the major thing that ended up scaring America enough to remove the sanctions. But still, I hope Iran moves forward with its cooperation with China for more economic stability and security." I can definitely see your point here. The Iran-China mega pact is a game changer whose effects can already be sensed. But that's not the only reason why the U.S. is jumping on the Iran deal bandwagon. They know they need it. And our last batch of tweet, the first one comes from Qasim Ibn al-Hassan. He says, "Given America's repeated misdeeds and growing divisions within the United States, the U.S. is unlikely to emerge from this glorious opportunity." And our final tweet of the day comes from Stop the Lobbyists. He just said, "Do not believe a word the U.S. says or signs." And that's been it for me and this edition of Hashtag Trending. It's time to get back to the studio now. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
Well, continuing with more news this hour, Saudi Arabia has executed three soldiers over what it calls committing high treason. The Saudi Defense Ministry says the trio collaborated with the kingdom's enemy. The ministry did not elaborate which enemy it believed the men aided. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who also holds the title of defense minister, has mounted sweeping crackdown on his critics and rivals over the past years. Now, the kingdom has also intensified its military campaign in Yemen. The war that began in March of 2015 has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead, many of them women and children. Well, people have gathered at rallies across Australia to protest the deaths of indigenous people in custody. Protests took place in cities including in Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, and the capital Canberra. More than 470 Aboriginals have died in police custody during the last three decades, including at least five since last month. No police officer or authority has ever been convicted for the so-called Black Deaths in custody. Demonstrations were held just days before the 30th anniversary of a report by a royal commission. The report was undertaken from 1987 to 1991. It found that Indigenous people were imprisoned at a much higher rate than non-Aboriginals. The commission made 339 recommendations, a few of which have been implemented. A study last year found that 75% of Australians hold an implicit bias against Aboriginals. Well, the United States has issued new guidelines in its relations with Taiwan, and yet another move that is likely to anger China. During our news review program, we've discussed the issue with our guests.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The U.S. State Department has issued new guidelines that enable officials to meet more freely with Taiwanese counterparts. The State Department spokesman said the aim of the guidelines is to encourage the U.S. government engagement with Taiwan. Ned Price said this deepens what he called an official relationship with the territory. The announcement comes amid heightened tensions between Washington and Beijing over the Chinese territory. This week, Beijing slammed Washington for sailing a warship through the Taiwan Strait again. China has also condemned the U.S. arms deal with Taiwan. Angelo Giuliano is a political analyst who joins us from Montreux, and we also have Marcus Papadopoulos as a historian, journalist, and author joining us from London. Well, another controversial move here, Marcus Papadopoulos, by the U.S. It shows like they are obviously displaying their militaristic approach when it comes to the Taiwan issue with China. Is that what they're doing?
Indeed. And what I'm about to say next might come as a surprise to some people. Indeed, it might come as a shock to some people. But nonetheless, I believe in saying things as they are. China has every right under international law to reclaim Taiwan by military force. China has every right under international law to extend its naval reach from mainland China all the way to Taiwan. Why? Because under international law, Taiwan is a part of China. The only reason why Taiwan is pretending to be an independent country is because in 1949, after the nationalists lost the Chinese Civil War to the communists, the leader of the nationalists, Chiang Kai-shek, and his soldiers fled to Taiwan, and at that time, China did not have the military strength, specifically the naval capacity, to launch an invasion of Taiwan in order to reclaim it. But the fact that Taiwan is a part of China is indisputable, is irrefutable. And the Americans have been, over decades, but in particular over the last 10 years, increasing their political, economic, and military ties with Taiwan, is simply because China is a growing force, not just in the region, but in the world. And to prevent, or to try and prevent, China from becoming a global superpower — remember, I would describe China as a regional superpower at present — but to try and prevent China from becoming a global superpower, as America is and as Russia is, the Americans are trying to limit China's power in the South China Sea. Because by limiting Chinese influence and power in South Asia, that will limit Chinese influence and power in the world as a whole. It is no different to what the Americans are doing in Eastern Europe, for example, in the Baltic states or in Ukraine. They are increasing their military presence there to try and contain Russian influence and power in Europe, and thereby contain Russian influence and power in the world. And the Americans only a few years ago installed a missile shield defense system in South Korea, which of course is aimed at the Chinese strategic nuclear deterrent. So the Americans have created a potentially volatile situation over Taiwan. Why? Because the Americans wish to preserve American global hegemony at all costs, and they wish to derail any other country in the world which is showing real signs of growing political, economic, and military power, as they have every right to do under international law.
Okay, Angelo Giuliano, looking at what happened on Wednesday, the Chinese actually sent more jets to the area in which Taiwan says that it will fight to the end if there is war. Is this the direction that this is going?
I think China would not go to this extreme. For China, what is important is to keep the status quo. He wants to make sure that Taiwan is not declaring independence. It's important to understand that right now in Taiwan, the politics has been hijacked by the U.S. Last October 2020, the State Department announced that they opened an office for the National Endowment for Democracy, remembering that the National Endowment for Democracy is just an extension of CIA, which is used around the world to destabilize, to create chaos, and also to create color revolutions. So basically, the State Department has been pushing and supporting the DPP, which is pro-independence, while the Kuomintang, the other party, is actually more in favor of reunification. So I think what is happening right now in Taiwan is nothing less than the continuation of the meddling of the U.S. in Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, we have a one-country system and it's a transitory system that should be for 50 years. What China wanted to do in this one country, two system was to show Taiwan that there was a possible reunification under one country, two system. And it was important for China to have this system to be successful. So what the DPP and USA did was just to push for chaos and to build up more fear in Taiwanese minds. So I don't think there's going to be war. You know, I think even the DPP is wise enough to know that they are being used as pawns in a proxy war between U.S. and China. I think right now it's just rhetoric. But again, this is a red line. Taiwan is a red line not to cross.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Angelo Giuliano, political analyst from Montreux. Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you, historian, journalist, and author. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of our News Review.
Myanmar's security forces have reportedly killed 82 anti-coup protesters on Thursday night and Friday. The Assistance Association for Political Prisoners says the killings happened in a town near the main city of Yangon. Troops used rifle grenades to break up protests in the town. Myanmar has been in turmoil since the civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi was ousted on February the 1st. The army has accused her of voter fraud. In the November elections, people have been holding rallies on an almost daily basis to demand a return to civilian rule. Security forces have killed over 600 people. Well, fresh lockdowns and curfews have been imposed in many countries across the globe amid a steep rise in coronavirus cases and related deaths. The new restrictions also come as vaccine rollouts have been hampered by shortages and scares over side effects. In India, curfews have been enforced in the worst-hit state of Maharashtra. Stay-at-home orders were also set to come into effect for 8 million inhabitants on the Colombian capital, Bogota, amid a third wave of infections there. Argentina also entered a nighttime curfew from Friday, running from midnight to 6 a.m. until April the 30th. Moreover, entire France is subject to restrictions of some form. In Germany, nighttime curfews and some school closures are likely to be enforced, especially in hard-hit areas. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Thousands of demonstrators across Britain held massive Kill the Bill rallies recently against a proposed law that would give police extra powers to curb protests and undermine freedom of speech. The proposed law, entitled Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, will allow police officers to take tougher measures to disperse demonstrations, such as imposing time and noise limits, which campaigners and activists fear would be used to curb dissent. We now present you an article written by Richard Sudan under the heading, More Power for UK Police Would Lead to Disaster. Please stay with us for more of Richard Sudan's article. The past few weeks have seen more and more questions and debates surface around the concern that Britain is fast becoming dangerously more authoritarian, with opposition and anger continuing to gain momentum as the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill makes its way through Parliament en route to becoming legislation. The British government claims that they need more powers to crack down on what they argue are episodes of unlawful disruption. But opponents to the move believe that more power in the hands of police officers, often already riddled with problems, simply spells outright disaster. The bill, which could become law, is causing such concern among the public that ironically it has produced more of what it aims to suppress in the form of mass protests taking place up and down the country. And the conduct of police in those protests has, for many people, actually helped make the case as to precisely why police officers should not be given any more powers. Critics say the police should simply manage the powers they already have and should not be given any more powers or discretion to decide what constitutes so-called disruption and what passes as legitimate protests. Part of what many people in Britain claim to be democracy is the freedom to protest and to hold the government and the powerful to account through demonstrating. Activists maintain that the law, which could further criminalise certain communities that are already marginalised, will almost certainly make it even easier for police officers to suppress any protests entirely. Some analysts have said that the power of protests, including the Black Lives Matter protests of last year, were too much for the authorities to handle in every respect. One of the more controversial scenes at the London protest was police protecting a statue of former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who is described as both supposedly the greatest Briton ever and also as a racist by various sections of the public, which happened in the wake of the toppling of a monument of Edward Colston. Some also strongly contend that the proposed legislation isn't simply about statutes or merely disruption. They say that the new powers for police are about controlling the power of the message of the protests, particularly as debates about the Black Lives Matter movement, racism, and also the royal family continue to rage. In many ways, the last few weeks have certainly proved to be a public relations disaster for police. Sarah Everard's tragic death several weeks ago, accompanied by the news that a Metropolitan Police officer had been charged with her murder, infuriated the public. It's also alleged that the police officer accused of her murder may have lured Sarah Everard to danger by using his identity as a police officer. Then the conduct of the police at a vigil for Everard further fermented that anger as footage began to emerge of female attendees literally being manhandled by male police officers at a time when both police and the issue of women's safety at the hands of men were being discussed across the nation. All of this cast focus and attention on the police bill, which, while not new, became the subject of renewed focus. As the protests demanding to kill the bill began to take place and swell to even greater numbers across Britain, some headlines and police forces began to circulate the claim and reports suggesting that protesters had instigated serious violence, including the suggestion that some police officers had even suffered broken bones. This was later acknowledged not to be the case. In recent days, too, it came to light that a police officer had also been a member of a banned neo-Nazi group and of being in possession of terror documents. While the police, quite rightly, took swift action, Instances like these have led many people to say that rather than being given more powers, police need to focus on reforming their recruitment procedures. And, in addition to addressing long-standing issues like deaths in custody, which disproportionately affect black communities. Protests against police acquiring yet more powers will likely continue as long as the possibility of the bill becoming law exists. In one alarming twist, a former senior-ranking police officer has even warned of the potential of the UK heading towards a culture of paramilitary policing, as part of the potential implications of the legislation. Opposition to the bill is clear and amplified from across the political spectrum, with former Prime Minister Theresa May even chiming into the debate. Millions of British citizens are adamant and resolute that rather than the police being afforded any more powers, they simply have a duty, must balance and responsibly manage the power they already have in order to safeguard the well-being of the public they exist to serve. Millions are also arguing that ultimately, rather than a police force, police must operate as a police service and aim to take steps to restore full confidence in the public. Moreover, the Metropolitan Police Force went out of its way to put down a large Kill the Bill protest in central London on Saturday, 3rd of April. According to the Metropolitan Police, which is responsible for enforcing law and order in the British capital, 107 people were arrested at the protest on various charges, including violent disorder, assault on police, and breaches of COVID-19 legislation. The large protest in central London on Saturday, 3rd of April, came in the wake of sustained protests in Bristol, which saw pitched battles between police officers and local people angry at proposed government legislation intended to crack down on so-called disruptive protesters. The Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill gives police officers and the broader criminal justice system wide-ranging new powers. Most controversially, the ability to impose stringent conditions on non-violent protests. Former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn lent his support to the protesters in central London on Saturday. Speaking in Parliament Square, Jeremy Corbyn brought up the defiant examples of the suffragettes and Nelson Mandela as he besieged the crowd to oppose the draconian bill. Describing the bill as a very dangerous, slippery slope, Jeremy Corbyn implored people to stand up for the right to protest, stand up for the right to have your voice heard.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, we send our peace and blessings upon all the prophets of Allah, Subhanahu wa Taala. And especially the last of them, Muhammadul Mustafa and his progeny, and those companions who followed their path. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life, here on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about psychological diseases and mental peace, and how we can achieve mental peace. And we also talked in the previous program about death, and about that everyone will one day face death, and how faith can help us and give us that strength and that power to help us out from anxiety, traumas, and other difficulties that we see in our society and within ourselves. Faith is the main cause, the main power, the main source that can help us to diminish all of those stress factors. And in this program, I will talk more about taslim and rida. Taslim means submission and devotion, and rida means satisfaction. A human being reaches a level where you feel satisfied. You feel that I am satisfied with what I have here and now. And that would give you joy and happiness. When you feel satisfaction, inner satisfaction, that would give you serenity too, except joy and happiness. And taslim, that you have done everything that was there to do in your power. And now you have reached a level where you have to be taslim. You have to submit to the will of Allah. There is no more to do. You have done all your tasks, all your duties to the best capable way you could, to the ultimate capacity of yours. One who does not possess the asset of faith is quite vulnerable against the unfavorable forces of nature. We consider ourselves a victim of its overwhelming and tyrannical forces. Even if we do not make a retreat in the first encounter with afflictions and hardships, ultimately, at some fearsome moment, the violent waves of events will drive us into a deep whirlpool. But one who relies on the logic of religion and does not consider anything except the will of Allah as being effective in the order of creation, believes that the unavoidable sufferings of life have been decreed by a beneficent Creator for the purification of our heart and the disciplining of our soul. Therefore, we do not allow hardship and affliction to paralyze our spiritual power. Rather, we maintain this serenity under all circumstances, or we try at least to maintain this serenity. Like the great friends of Allah, awliya Allah, they would maintain this serenity under all circumstances and in every eventuality that steers the ship of his existence with the help of God's eternal power to the shores of purity, success, and felicity. And even if his spiritual joys and pleasures increase despite the burden of suffering, the awliya Allah, they maintain their serenity under all circumstances. In every eventuality, they steer the ship of life, of their existence, with the help of God, to the shores of purity, success, and felicity.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? is Allah satisfied.
Jabir ibn Abdullah was one of the great personalities in Islam and one of the companions of the Prophet and five Imams, all the way to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. He was one of those personalities that had been brought up under Islamic teachings. Once, when he fell ill, Imam Baqir alayhi salam came to his house to visit this great companion. When the Imam asked Jabir about his condition, the latter replied, "My condition is such that I prefer old age to youth, sickness to health, and death to life." The Imam alayhi salam said to him, "Yet we, the Prophet's family, are not such. If God decrees sickness or health, youth or old age, life or death for one of us, we accept it most willingly." Thus, the principle of rida, satisfaction, vis-a-vis the vicissitudes of life, is our custom. Do you know what the Imam is trying to say here? Do not choose anything. Do not choose between being a youth or being an old person. Do not choose between death or life. But let that be, or between wealth and poverty, but let that be in the hands of Allah. You do your best here in this life, and you let the decision of death or life, poverty or wealth, health or sickness, be in the hands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's what the Imam is talking about. He's saying, be taslim, submit to the will of Allah in any condition. So if Allah wants death, then let it be death. If Allah wants health, then let it be health. Be completely submitted to the will of Allah. The great philosopher Bertrand Russell says, "Resignation, however, has also its part to play in the conquest of happiness, and it is a part no less essential than that played by effort. The wise man, though he will not sit down under preventable misfortunes, will not waste time and emotion upon such as are unavoidable. And when such as are in themselves avoidable, he will submit to it, if the time and labor required to avoid them would interfere with the pursuit of some more important project. Many people get into a fury over every little thing that goes wrong, and in this way waste a great deal of energy that might be more usefully employed. Even in the pursuit of really important objects, it is unwise to become so deeply involved emotionally that the thought of possible failure becomes a constant menace to peace of mind." More of this, inshallah ta'ala, in future programs, where we will talk more about how to reach the level, the station of submission and satisfaction to get a mental peace. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
It's all I need.
It's all I need.
All I need.
You need to me, 'cause your love is all I need.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
While 2020 will be remembered for the global coronavirus pandemic, it also will go down as a year marked by resurgent criminal violence that may end up spelling serious trouble for American cities, says Raphael A. Mangel, writer, in an article titled U.S. Cities Got Deadlier in 2020. Stay tuned for the details, please. For those who follow urban American history, the most remarkable story of the 20th century's last decade has to be what's now widely known as the Great Crime Decline. While 2020 most assuredly will be remembered for the global coronavirus pandemic, it also will go down as a year marked by resurgent criminal violence that may end up spelling serious trouble for American cities, especially if they botch their responses to it. In 1991, the U.S. saw almost 25,000 homicides, a rate of 9.8 per 100,000. The country's deadly crime problem was then, as it is now, heavily concentrated in cities. New York City alone accounted for almost 10% of all homicides in 1991. Chicago, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. together accounted for another 10%. Representing one of the greatest victories by the turn of the century, annual homicides were down by more than 9,000, a decline concentrated heavily in and around America's urban centers, though the final numbers won't be available for months. Criminologists estimate that 2020 will have seen, for the first time since mid-1990s, more than 20,000 criminal homicides.
Thank you.
And once again, a sizable portion of the 2020 spike occurred in urban jurisdictions, big, medium, and small. New York, which also had seen homicides rise, in 2018 and 2019 saw almost 150 additional homicides and more than 750 additional shootings in 2020, representing respective increases of 45% and 97%. Chicago, which hadn't yet fully recovered from homicide spikes in 2015 and 16, saw 274 more homicides and 1,435 additional shootings in 2020, 55% spikes. LA saw homicides jump approximately 38%, or nearly 100, while shootings spiked almost 40%. DC closed 2020 with homicides up for the third year, this time by almost 20%, or 32 more deaths. Killings in Philadelphia, where year-end homicides have risen every year since 2016, were just one body shy of 500, a 40% increase. Louisville saw homicides jump by more than 70%, shattering a record set in 2016. And also, there are other numbers. The 66 cities that responded to the Major City Chiefs Association's year-end violent crime survey collectively saw 1,990 more murders in 2020 than in 2019, which is almost half of the 4,000 additional murders experts have estimated occurred in 2020. What should cities do about this? The answer depends on how they view the problem. In the wake of last year's increasing murders, some commentators expressed concern about what looked like the makings of an extended violent crime wave. Others have struck a more calming note, reminding the public that despite the increase, the U.S. is still faring much better than it was in the bad old days of the early 1990s. This is true, strictly speaking, but it's not a particularly helpful observation for a couple of reasons. First, in many cities, homicide numbers actually have neared or surpassed their early 1990s peaks. Second, murders and shootings generally are hyper-concentrated at the micro-geographic level, and the national murder rate doesn't paint anything close to an accurate picture of how safe or unsafe those places are. Why some are not yet willing to sound the alarm likely stems from the uncertainty regarding the cause of what seems like a widely distributed uptick in lethal criminal violence. There is a sharp disagreement about what might be driving homicide upward, one that in many ways mirrors the ongoing debate about what was behind the great crime decline. Some experts have argued that the spike is a temporary side effect of the pandemic brought on by its economic impact, particularly with respect to unemployment. But this is in tension with the broader data on violent crimes such as homicides and economic indicators, which does not reveal a clear relationship between the two. In New York, for example, the poverty rate in 1989, the year before homicides hit a record high, 2,262, was actually slightly lower than it was in 2016, the year before Big Apple homicides hit a record low, 292. And during the Great Recession, the national homicide rate actually declined by 15%, going from 5.7 per 100,000 in 2007 to 4.8 per 100,000 in 2010, a period in which the civilian unemployment rate rose from 4.6 to 9.3%. The pandemic explanation also is complicated by the fact that the homicide spikes across the U.S. has been driven by a much narrower slice of the population than has been impacted by the pandemic. Perhaps what we see in 2020 and in many cities continue to see through the first quarter of 2021 has more to do with a combination of factors related to policing and criminal justice. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyyina wa Mawlana Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad wa ala Ahli Baytihi al-Tayyibin al-Tahirin al-Ma'sumin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. We have been currently discussing the tradition of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in which he mentions the regiments or the units that form the army of the intellect, that is the aql, and that of ignorance, that is jahl. And we've reached this section of the tradition where the Imam is mentioning these types of regiments, these units. And we've come to this part of the tradition where the Imam alayhi salam brings again two more units or regiments. And we explain why the Imam alayhi salam uses the term regiments in the plural form, in that each one of these specific characteristics and traits has many different reference and instances in the outside world where they can be seen, whether it be in the line of the intellect or whether it be in the line of ignorance. So here the Imam mentions two others, one obviously for intellect, the one for jahal or ignorance. And he mentions the one for intellect is known as ra'fah, or which can be translated as tender-heartedness, that a person is very soft, a person is very sensitive. And obviously, that characteristic which is in direct conflict with this tender-heartedness, obviously, is known as qaswa, or hard-heartedness, where a person's heart is blackened, as we know the term of qaswatul qulub, where the heart is completely blackened and no light can penetrate it. So what is ra'fa, or this tender-heartedness? Some of the scholars of semantics have mentioned that ra'fa is like rahmah, it's mercy, but a very intense form of mercy. For example, we as human beings within us have this tenderness. For example, we do not like to see others in pain. This is something that you, normal human being, should have, unfortunately, because of our way we act and the sins that we do. And we become accustomed to certain things by watching TV, playing video games and so on and so forth. Not to say that we will do these things, no. That's another discussion altogether. But we have become accustomed to certain things where our hearts have become, not hardened, but accustomed. Whereas a hard-heartedness is that a person at times may not be affected, but rather enjoys seeing certain things. Where someone's in pain, he takes pleasure in it. When someone requires help, he takes pleasure in having the ability to help but not helping. You know, he feels joy and then comfort in this. So these are the two other characteristics that the Imam has mentioned, one being ra'fa and the other being qaswa. Inshallah, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us that ra'fa, inshallah, and make our hearts tender the way that He has created us, inshallah. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.